On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin, Mr. Brian Chee here. We discuss just how crowdsourcing is giving companies a quicker and less costly way of developing and testing applications. We have a great discussion there. Plus, we have an exciting guest here today. We have Hillary Hunter. She's the VP and CTO of IBM Cloud Services. We're going to go through all kinds of interesting topics, including confidential computing and ensuring security across your entire compute lifecycle. Shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to making securing employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 416, recorded October 23rd, 2020. Cloud is a bag of cats. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at one-fifth the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition, with no fees for egress or API requests and no complex storage tiers. Start a free trial at wasabi.com and enter code ENTERPRISE. And by Forward Networks. Forward Networks reduces business risk by revolutionizing the way large networks are managed. Their advanced software delivers a digital twin of the network, a completely accurate mathematical model in software. Get a demo at forwardnetworks.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. We need to bring in the experts to guide us on this journey, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's here with us today. He's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading and one of the busiest journalists I know. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend?
Lou, doing quite well. We're having a good time at Dark Reading, following all the stuff going on, all the various bits and pieces of the security world coming together. And wouldn't you know it, I get to talk to interesting people. So for me, it's a happy time. Got some stuff to tell you about at the end of the show, because I have some exciting articles on the way. But in the meantime, it's kind of nice to take a break and join everyone here on Twyatt.
Well, speaking of busy, we also have our geek in paradise. He's the net architect over there at Sky Fiber, Mr. Brian Chee-Chiebert. How are you doing, my friend? What's going on this week for you?
I'm having a great time. In fact, I am actually working with some beta equipment from Siklu Networks. It is a 60 gigahertz millimeter wave radio system. What's cool is it looks like a big, like, coffee can, but it has four sector antennas inside it. And it's actually going to be compatible with the Facebook Terragraph project. But we're going to use that at the University of Hawaii to try and reach some areas that were hard to put security cameras in. And hopefully, if all goes well, I'm going to be putting in a new Axis camera with Canon optics, 40x optical zoom, and a radar to control where it's pointing. And maybe, just maybe, we can try and catch these people that are giving us problems, stealing from our faculty in their housing area.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, what do those things usually go for? Because that sounds like a very expensive device.
The camera is not horrible. It's in the $4,000 range. But considering I can use one camera and cover a really, really large area and zoom in enough that I can actually do license plate recognition, not that expensive. And the license plate recognition software actually installs onto the camera itself. So fun.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, folks, speaking of busy, we've had quite the busy week in the enterprise. So let's get started now. Software crowdsourcing is actually making inroads in the software industry. And this may be because it gives companies a quicker and less costly way of developing and testing apps. We'll definitely discuss that. Plus, a lot of you have a ton of IoT devices on your network. I bet you go check right now, you do. And we're going to discuss just how you might pinpoint some of the rogue ones on there. Plus, we have an exciting guest today, Hillary Hunter. She's the VP and CTO of IBM Cloud Services, and we're going to go through all kinds of interesting topics, including talking about confidential computing and ensuring security across your entire compute lifecycle. But before we get into all that, let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now, it's that time of year where cyber threats soar and the fingers are all pointed all over the place, but it seems the fingers continue to point at Russia. Now, the U.S. Department of Justice has unsealed charges this week against six Russian internationals believed to be members of the Russian elite hacker and cyber war unit known as Sandworm. Now, it reminds me of something from the movie Dune. Now, in court documents this week, U.S. officials said all six suspects are officers in Unit 74455 of the Russian main intelligence group known as GRU, military intelligence agency, part of the Russian army. Now, as part of this unit, U.S. officials said that the six conducted destructive and cyber attacks on behalf and under orders of the Russian government with the intent to destabilize our countries and interfere in their internal politics and cause havoc and monetary losses. Now, you may be wondering, how effective are they? Well, listen to some of their attacks known to date. The group orchestrated destructive malware attacks against Ukrainian's electric power grid and the Ukraine Ministry of Finance and the Ukraine State Treasury Service using malware that altered industrial equipment or wiped hard drives using KillDesk. Now, in 2017, Sandworm orchestrated spear phishing campaigns and related hack and leak efforts targeting the French president's political party. Also in 2017, they released NotPetya ransomware, initially aimed at Ukrainian companies. That the ransomware quickly spread and impacted companies worldwide, causing more than $1 billion to victims. The Winter Olympics of 2017 and 2018 were also a target, and also the country of Jordan that year. Unfortunately, this is only a small fraction of the attacks over the years by this group. In fact, if you search around the net, even just for the group names such as Telebots or Black Energy, Voodoo Bear, and other code names, you'll find they're actually linked back to Sandworm. Now, as the technology and threats progress, it will be harder and harder to detect these type of attacks and track them back to such groups. Let's hope the defensive technologies progress as well.
Well, a new botnet is infecting hundreds of thousands of websites. A botnet focusing on crypto mining, spamming, and defacement has infected hundreds of thousands of websites running popular content management systems such as WordPress, Joomla, Magneto, and Drupal. That's according to online security firm Imperva. The botnet, dubbed Cashmere Black, uses a modular infrastructure that includes advanced features like load balancing communications with C and C servers and storing files on cloud storage services like Dropbox and GitHub, all to speed access to any new code updates for the systems infected with the software. The Cashmere Black botnet mainly infects these popular CMS platforms, exploiting dozens of known vulnerabilities on targeted servers and performing millions of attacks per day on average. The botnet's high-performance architecture, designed to make updating easy, made an impression on the researchers. They say the botnet uses two clusters of infected systems as repositories for code and exploits, and divides compromised systems into those actively seeking new bots and a larger group waiting for instructions. In addition, they say the botnet has quickly changed over the last 11 months. In September, for example, the botnet operators changed the CNC capability to use the Dropbox API to store logs of its operations and retrieve commands. Nadav Avital, head of threat research at Imperva, says, "The important thing here is to understand that botnet activity is dynamic. It's not like you can block this or put some security rule on it once and be done."
If there was any doubt that containers and microservices is gaining traction, I bring up Amazon's pithily named Bottle Rocket. While at its simplest description, it's a stripped-down Linux for containers, but has the integration into the AWS ecosystem to make bringing up microservices in the cloud that much easier. What bothers me a bit about this whole concept is that when you strip down an operating system, are the functions like monitoring, security APIs, and the like sacrificed? It's interesting because it's almost like I'm harking back to the mainframe days where I had a full-featured supervisory system as an umbrella over my apps that could operate in jailed-off segments. Is this what Amazon is moving towards? No. Are we migrating back to that model as people like Amazon wrap larger ecosystems around micro machines like Bottle Rocket? Who knows? Some would say, though, that if you strip out all the extra stuff surrounding a modern operating system, you can't hack what's not there. So,
You heard my last blip. I bet you can't guess who might be blamed for the next cyber attack. That's right. Another Russian hacker group known as Energetic Bear. Now, they are a Russian state-sponsored hacking group who has stolen data from two servers after targeting state and federal government networks in the U.S. since at least September, the FBI and Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency said this week. Now, the Director of National Intelligence, John Radcliffe, announced this week that Iran and Russia have obtained voter registration information that could be used to undermine confidence in the U.S. election system. Now, the FBI and CISA said that they do not have evidence that Energetic Bear compromised election data or government operations just yet. In at least one compromise of a state or local government server, Energetic Bear accessed documents related to sensitive passwords, vendors, and printing access badges. However, the foreign actor may seek access to obtain future disruption options, influence U.S. policies and actions, or discrete government entities. And the bottom line here is this year will continue to be a challenging year, including one where a presidential race could be influenced by foreign adversaries.
Well, in more exciting security news, 7 mobile browsers are vulnerable to address bar spoofing. Security vendor Rapid7, in collaboration with independent researcher Rafe Balak, this week disclosed details on new vulnerabilities in 7 mobile browsers, including Safari and Opera, that allow attackers to spoof information showed in the browser's address bar. The vulnerabilities allow an attacker to control both the content of a website and the apparent source of the website, which can lead to very convincing-looking but malicious web pages. The issues identified by Rafe Balak's research are all unique issues per browser, but they all fall in the general vulnerability category described by CWE-451, or user interface misrepresentation of critical information. In all instances, a mobile user would need to be lured to an attacker-controlled website to be infected. In addition to Safari and Opera, the other impacted mobile browsers include those from Yandex, UC Web, and Raise IT Solutions. According to research, UC Web's UC browser has more than 500 million downloads, while the Yandex browser has over 100 million. Now, so far, only Apple and Opera have addressed the vulnerabilities in their browsers after being notified of the problem in August. Speaking of the vulnerability, how does it work? By messing with the timing between page loads and when the browser gets a chance to refresh the address bar, an attacker using JavaScript can cause either a pop-up to appear to come from an arbitrary website or can render content in the browser window that falsely appears to come from an arbitrary website.
Well, a day after the Barnes & Noble revealed its Nook outage, the bookstore revealed a far more serious problem. A massive cybersecurity attack breached the company's data, exposing information about customers, including email addresses and other personal information. A couple weeks ago, Barnes & Noble sent customers an email to notify them about the cyber attack. The company made clear that the customer's financial information had not been exposed. Their transaction history, however, was. The company said transaction history, meaning purchase information related to the books and other products that you have bought from us, were retained in the system and were impacted by the cybersecurity attack. Subsequent updates were sent indicating Barnes & Noble has refused to pay the ransom and is instead in the process of restoring their systems. To date, I've been hearing daily updates from my wife with about her 14,000 plus titles and features gradually appearing back on her Nook platform. I've wondered if perhaps the IT folks at Barnes & Noble learned some hard lessons from the likes of Target, Home Depot, and others, where too often little or no security separation existed between business units within a company, allowing the hackers to pivot from the corporate network into point-of-sale and online sales systems. I guess the saving grace is they maintain no credit card information was compromised.
Now, machine learning has been touted as the next thing in the next industrial revolution. It has its goods and its bads. It doesn't always get it right, especially if you know how to feed it misinformation. However, nothing else, machine learning can be scary with how right it sometimes can be. Machine learning can correctly guess a lot of things about you, including some of the most sensitive information. For instance, it can reliably predict your sexual orientation, whether you're pregnant or whether you want to quit your job or not, or whether you're likely to die soon. That's crazy. Now, researchers can predict race based on Facebook likes, and officials in China use facial recognition to identify and track the minority ethnic groups that are out there. Now, do the machines actually know these things, or are they making informed guesses? And if they're making an inference about you, just the same as any human you know might do, is there really anything wrong with them being so astute? Well, let's chat about a couple cases here. In the U.S., Target's story predicting who's pregnant is probably the most famous example of an algorithm making sensitive inferences about people. There was a small fallout due to this because some parents were actually alerted to their children being pregnant before they were even told. Now, think about that for a second. Somehow, Target inferred this from purchases or obtained health information that normally organizations are regulated to have. So are we ironically facing a downside when predictive models perform too well? Well, we know there's actually a cost when models predict incorrectly, but is there also a cost when they predict correctly? Well, it's easy to think of reasons why people wouldn't want someone to know these things. Like as of 2013, Hewlett-Packard was predictably scoring its more than 300,000 workers with the probability of whether they are going to quit their job or not. Now, as another example, facial recognition technologies can serve as a way to track location, decreasing the fundamental freedom to move about without disclosure, since, for example, publicly positioned security cameras can identify people at specific times and places. Now, research has also shown that predictive models can also discern another bunch of personal traits here, attributes such as race and ethnicity. Now, this brings us to China. Now, their government applies facial recognition to identify and track members of different ethnic groups, which are oppressed by the government. Now, the first known case of the government using machine learning to profile ethnicity, it's actually a real challenge to draw a line as to which predictive objectives pursued with machine learning are ethical, let alone which should be legislated against, if any. But at the very least, it's important to stay vigilant when machine learning serves to empower a pre-existing unethical practice and when it generates the data that must be handled with care. Well, folks, that does it for the Blips. Next up, the Bites. But before we get to the Bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. And Wasabi is just that cloud storage provider that's disrupting the cloud market. That's right. Plus, they have a perfect solution for managed service providers because they earn more while charging less. It's also 80% cheaper than Amazon S3 and significantly cheaper than on-premise storage. Typically, you can store data in Wasabi's cloud for less than just the maintenance fees or annual costs on the same amount of on-prem storage. And Wasabi's disruptive price performance model makes buying cloud storage a natural addition. Now, there are two ways you can pay here. You can pay as you go, or you can pay a one-time with reserved capacity storage. Wasabi's reserved capacity storage makes buying cloud storage a natural addition to your on-prem storage. Now, if you're thinking about buying more hardware storage, you should go and compare the price against 5 years of reserved capacity storage. You'll be pleasantly surprised there. Now, you can purchase cloud storage in 1, 3, or 5 year increments and achieve greater discounts for term and capacity. Now, if you aren't thinking about price and more around security, availability, and performance, think about this. Wasabi security is often even greater than on-premise stores. In fact, they also provide 11 nines of durability. This means on average, you'll lose one file every 649,000 years. So you're not going to lose a file there. Plus, they are hosted in premier tier 4 data center facilities that are highly secure and fully redundant. Now, Wasabi is secure by default, and all data stored in Wasabi Cloud is always encrypted at rest, even if the requesting party doesn't specify whether they want encryption or not. Now, Wasabi follows industry best security models and design practices. In fact, they have access control mechanisms such as bucket policies and access control lists can be used to selectively grant the permissions to the data. Now, your data will be immutable, which means preventing data from being erased or altered, and you'll be protected from hackers, malware, and even yourself. Now, Wasabi has active integrity checking where all objects stored are checked for integrity every 90 days. If your organization is focused on compliance, they have you covered as well. They are HIPAA, FINRA, and CGIS compliant. Wasabi is not just highly secure, disruptive technology is turning the industry on its ears. It stores its 80% cheaper and up to 6 times faster than the industry leader. Calculate the savings for yourself and start a free trial of storage for a month. Go to Wasabi.com, click the free trial link, and enter code ENTERPRISE. Join the movement and migrate your data to the cloud with confidence. Go to Wasabi.com and make sure you use the offer code ENTERPRISE. We thank Wasabi for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, if you've been developing a product or maybe even a piece of software, you continue to look for ways to increase the value of that software, right? And the way to get more feedback and more feedback loops. Well, how can you test these features and changes or even new products with consumers without having to incur additional overhead or costs internally? Well, one way is actually crowdsourcing. Now, it does work for open source. Why not work for products as well? Crowdsourcing has drawn a lot of attention as a way of predicting and mapping future coronavirus hotspots based on user-reported symptoms. However, it's also an increasingly popular approach to software and application testing, engineering, and quality assurance. Now, software crowdsourcing is making inroads in the software industry, and it gives companies a way to develop quicker, less costly ways of developing and even testing applications. And this is a way you can actually meet the real user's needs. Well, hopefully. Now, meanwhile, individual crossroad testers or crowdsource testers, also known as crowd testers, are earning money through remote work, ranging from a few dollars for each detected bug to weekly salaries of almost up to $2,000. Now, in crowdsourcing, people can contribute to a collaborative platform over the internet from wherever they are. It's well known outside the software development field as well. As example, the Wikipedia Online Collaborative Encyclopedia, you know that, you've used that. That they also use crowdsourcing. A couple other places are Quora and Stack Exchange, web-based platforms where people actually ask and answer questions out there about technology. Crowdsourcing has also made headlines lately as a way of predicting and mapping future COVID-19 spots based on user-reported symptoms. Now, in software development, crowdsourcing is used actually in design requirements, analysis, and even coding. Get that. But as a business endeavor, crowdsourcing is getting especially prevalent in testing and quality assurance tasks. Now, as a requester, a business delegate tasks to outside individuals or groups as providers with the support of crowdsourcing platforms. Now, the firm pays a fee onto that platform, which then performs various candidate vetting and then task management. And then the crowdsourcing company also handles payments to the testers. Now, the global crowdsourcing testing market is set to soar from $1.3 billion in 2019 to $2 billion by 2024. Now, that's actually a recent report by Markets and Markets. Now, what's the appeal here? Well, inexpensive insights without hiring new people. That's definitely looking great for businesses. Now, there are downsides to every side of the coin. Now, consistency is one of them. Now, what if a group of people actually don't get the feature? They get the feature first, but then they have a skewed point of view or maybe a skewed piece of feedback that can actually hurt the testing feedback loop. Open source is a great example of crowdsourcing. There is an entire industry surrounding it. However, the paying side of the crowdsourcing is a totally different animal from open source. It has itself well-known been crowded with competing platforms. In fact, many online labor markets use this model known as microtasking, where microtasks is actually intended to be done in a matter of minutes. Collectively, though, the microtasks add up to a solution for a more complex task. You'll find individual sites that supply a wide range of crowd testing services and are actually looking for testers. Now, let's go through some of the disadvantages and advantages of crowdsourcing, and then I want to bring my co-host back in. So first thing is you can hire a large number of people quickly and get almost immediate feedback from them. So that's one of the pretty good advantages to it. It can be low cost, and it's actually a quick way to get feedback. You can gain even new insights into different parts of the market you didn't actually focus on before. For example, you can access a diverse set of ideas and languages in localization projects. This can help with much more useful than translation-based approaches. Now, there are some drawbacks. Crowdsourcing suffers from the same commitment problem as open sourcing. Participants actually who are committed at the start and their interest kind of wane off over time, and you actually lose that viability, that usability of crowdsourcing. Depending on the approach you choose, you might experience even higher error rates with crowd testers that are with dedicated test teams, according to professionals. Test glitches can be expensive and time-consuming when you run into these problems. Now, depending on the audience, the feedback area, like UX user experience or UX, you can sometimes be missing a diverse amount of feedback and it could actually be vague and unuseful to you. So obviously, we see a lot of advantages and disadvantages, but it definitely is a growing market here. I want to bring my co-host in. Now, I want to start with you, Curtis. we see a lot of organizations, a lot of businesses looking to crowdsourcing as a way to scale out their business, scale out their testing, get the feedback fast, iterate quickly. Is it a sustainable model?
Well, I tend to think that it is sustainable as a way to expand your testing capabilities. I think if you consider crowdsourcing to be your testing capabilities, you've got a real problem. And that's what I worry about. I mean, if a company says we've got a large user base, we can do in-house testing or contract testing to a particular point, but then to really get a lot of feedback, we want to go to crowdsourcing, all for it. I think that works great. When a company says, you know, our sales have been down, I think we'll just fire all of our testers and get crowdsourcing people to do it. I think you have a problem because you can lack rigor in your testing. And when you start lacking rigor, well, volume's not going to make up for lack of quality. And I think that is where we're going to see some real issues come about, because while I like a lot of the crowdsourcing people, I like a lot of the crowdsourcing platforms, there are limitations that need to be acknowledged.
Right. Yeah, I think there's definitely a trade-off here. Cheebert, I want to throw this to you. Do you think that it's really worth hiring these extra groups, these extra eyes for bugs, or does it make sense to just do the old traditional methods?
I'm actually going to go with Kurt on what I think is happening, but I'm going to add something to it. There's, from working with some various intelligence agencies, shall we say, there was an acronym that's, very appropriate also for the crowdsourcing world, and that's MICE. And we define it as money, ideology, conscience, and ego. I think those should be kept in mind, because if you really and truly do the math, the amount of time a lot of people put into this might not even come out to minimum wage. So there has to be additional motivation in there. I saw a lot of this when my student Warren Togami was trying to get the Fedora project off the ground. It had floundered once, and then he managed to convince Red Hat to let him try again. And we based it out of my lab in Honolulu. It, shall we say, succeeded. But there was a lot of ego stroking to try and get people to fulfill their commitments, to make sure that they're doing the same kinds of things, make sure we have some sort of quality, some sort of consistency to testing the modules. So, yes, I completely agree with Kurt. It cannot be your do-all, cannot be your only testing. It should be how to get those additional eyes, additional skills to see things from a different light. Because no matter how good your in-house people are, they're, shall we say, too close to the problem. Having someone removed away from the day-to-day being embroiled with this particular product means someone might see just that little bit different way of looking at things and help you find that niggly little bug that's driving you absolutely batty.
That's true. There are some of those out there too. Curtis, I want to ask you one more question here, because I think outsourcing is a big deal. But the question is, we've seen a lot of companies actually use bug bounties, where, you know, or even security bug bounties to fairly successfully, because again, people make a lot more money here. They find the deeper issues, and they're paid just as how much valuable information, valuable data, valuable bugs they provide. So it seems like a more useful way to make more money, but also a more useful way to find the deeper issues. Do you think that's more of a security, I mean, more of a scalable model, or is it similar in crowdsourcing case?
No, I think it is a more scalable model, because frankly, I think that you can use it as sort of a level two or layer two security means. Obviously, you're going to want to do basic security testing during the development process. But when it comes time to really looking at the security issues that can exist in very complex systems, I think that the bug bounty method has a lot to recommend it. Why? Because it works. I've talked to executives from several of the bug bounty platforms, things like BugCrowd. And the participants in that do find a significant number of bugs in the applications and operating systems that they're testing. They're often paid quite well for it, so they have incentive to really poke on those systems hard, find the bugs, and then sell them to the vendor through the bug bounty platform, rather than doing what black hat hackers would do, which is find the bugs and sell them to attackers on the black market. So I think it works. It's been proven to work. And I frankly think we're going to see an awful lot more of it.
So Chris brings up a good point here, Cheever. I want to throw this back to you. You know, obviously there's the bug bounties, the ones that deal with security and so on. What if an organization crowdsourced in different facets of the market? Like, for instance, if they want to know more about localization, whether they're doing well at, you know, localizing their application, or they wanted better accessibility feedback, or they wanted, you know, better security feedback, they could just outsource or crowdsource testing in that parts of the market. So they might pay a little bit more for different facets of the market, but they still might be able to get better feedback quicker, faster than sending it out to their users or maybe even hiring internal people. Will that potentially fix the problem or a lot of some of the problems we see with crowdsourcing?
Actually, I don't think it actually is going to cost more. I think in reality, it costs less. So I'm going to go back to way back into my early days when I was with Xerox. And in those days, when you wrote manuals, you actually had the staff in that physical location. So maybe if we want Japanese, we had people in Xerox Fuji, which was out of the Mount Fuji area. They would write the manuals. So they had an outline with the technical facts in it, would write a brand new version of the manual. It was a horribly expensive way of doing things. So outsourcing that to people that, you know, there are actual real certifications for translations and things like that. Having someone in that locale. So if we had someone that normally works on board of, say, a cruise ship. Testing in a cruise ship environment is radically different from testing in your comfortable offices. Having someone actually testing, I was actually involved in some testing where we had people test it in the during the Gulf War. And wow, I had no idea. They were beating on me because they say, hey, dude, this thing takes 5 minutes to boot up. In 5 minutes, we could all be dead. Very, very valuable information and something we could never predict it in-house. So it shouldn't be your only testing, but darn, having local feet on the ground can make a really big difference. We've all seen those joke memes on social media about the horrible translations from non-English speakers, and it's absolutely hilarious. Well, think of what would happen if that's an operating manual or a piece of software that someone's life is on the line. So yeah, I think localization is a really good way of using crowdsourced testing. And I think everybody should consider doing it. In fact, maybe some students. A lot of my students actually used to do that kind of stuff and earn a little bit of extra money.
Indeed. You know, it's interesting because there are businesses out there, a lot smaller, some SMBs, maybe some startups, that can definitely take advantage and get advantage of the crowdsourcing model. And because it is a potential one-time cost when they're shipping their first product or MVP or even some additional iterative approaches to features thereafter. And I think, you know, although it's not like you all are saying, it's not the only approach that you should be doing here, it definitely does help because you can have a potential small startup that only has a couple of developers, maybe a designer or maybe even just a PM. And, you know, you're basically trying to release a product that will definitely hit the market and hit the ground running. And you have maybe potential some investors, you know, watching this all from afar. You want it to do well. And I think by paying these different parts of the market, by crowdsourcing different facets of the features and the application, it might be a hit or cost up front. but you gain that initial feedback and that you seed the feedback into the system. So I definitely think this is an interesting thought process and initiative process. We'll definitely see it, I'm sure, like we've seen grow in the coming years. But in the same sense, we might even see some new markets come out of it. We'll have to see. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we have a really great guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. But before we get to our guest, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Forward Networks. Now, we know your network is mission critical to your business. Well, Forward Networks will help you reduce network outages, improve troubleshooting, and eliminate errors very quickly. They reduce business risk by revolutionizing the way large networks are managed. Now, four Stanford PhD graduates developed Forward Networks 7 years ago. They developed empathy for network operators and sought to apply modern software development principles to the network. Now, their advanced software delivers a digital twin of the network, a completely accurate mathematical model and software. It serves as a single source of truth for the network. Now, users can then verify that their network is configured correctly, that it complies with policies, and that it's behaving exactly as they intended to behave. Now, they can accurately predict the impact of proposed changes across every possible traffic path, so network operators can roll out changes with confidence without worrying about how that's going to affect the network. Now, this ensures that your network stays healthy and agile at all times. Now, here are some of the other things that Forward Network does. Now, their dashboard provides key network insights with visualizations that can easily be consumable and exportable. They automatically create an always accurate network diagram with full details about the topology of your environment. Plus, they have search network behavior and configuration and state network-wide with an intuitive powerful tool. They can perform end-to-end path analysis across your network from both on-prem and cloud infrastructure. They can proactively identify potential connectivity and security policy violations. Plus, they verify that your network is configured and behaving exactly as intended across on-prem, cloud, and virtual overlay networks. Plus, they set, check, and customize policies for your entire network. They also have behavior diffs. You can actually allow side-by-side comparisons and one quick view of your configuration file changes for any device between any point in time. You get 50% faster resolution of network trouble tickets, and you get 90% faster fix related to audit processes and 33% reduction in aborted network updates due to identified errors right away. Imagine searching your network for what is causing problems. Forward Networks allows you to do that really easily. Now, PayPal has been having issues with their network and considered building a better system. Instead, they actually turned to Forward Networks and found that all they needed was a software that can find the trouble spots, saving them time and money. Forward Networks collaborates with a range of infrastructure and application technology partners, from world's leading IT companies to innovators. They work with Bank of America, Verizon, Goldman Sachs, and several large government agencies as well. Forward Networks announced their Series C funding round last October, led by Goldman Sachs. Also participating were Andreessen Horowitz and Threshold, formerly DFJ. In total, their investors committed $65 million. Get network automation and verification for your intent-based network with Forward Networks. Your business depends on it. Go to demo at forwardnetworks.com/twit. That is forwardnetworks.com/twit. And we thank Forward Networks for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. Today we have Hillary Hunter. She is the VP and CTO of IBM Cloud Services. Welcome to the show, Hillary.
Thanks so much. A pleasure to be here with you today.
We're excited because we have a ton of things to talk about here. But before we get to all that, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us on a short journey through tech and where it brought you to IBM Cloud?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I was somebody who as a kid loved math and science. If you had asked me what my favorite topics were growing up and my favorite school subjects. So for me, engineering grew out of a love of wanting to apply that. I wanted to do math and science, but do it in a way that was a little bit more hands-on, a little bit more practical, and have tangible outcomes. And so I looked at all different kinds of engineering and decided I wanted to do electrical engineering, ended up then really loving the kind of logical flow of what happens in computing, and grew up to become a computer architect, so to say. And so at IBM, I've had the opportunity to work in our research organization, now in our cloud organization, work closely with our systems businesses. And I get to apply all of that engineering training. You know, we do things that go all the way down into the transistors and the cryptographic, techniques that are used to protect data, all the way up through what a cloud is and what a cloud does. And so it's really neat to be at a place where we're spanning that whole technology stack, and I can really bring that love of math and science, you know, in its entirety into what I get to do every day with our customers.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah, we hear a lot about cloud computing, cloud services, and a lot about secure cloud services. A lot of government agencies are looking for this, and we hear a lot of about the news about things going on and people getting contracts for these things. But I did want to bring our audience back a little bit and try to get everyone on the same page. Can you maybe tell the audience a little bit about what confidential computing is and what it supports and what it does?
Yeah, you know, it's certainly a hot topic right now. So appreciate the chance to talk with you about it. You know, confidential computing is really about giving someone control at the workload level. So the software and the data, giving them privacy and control, even when they're running on someone else's infrastructure, on a cloud infrastructure, as an example. And so confidential computing is about having trust. It's about having confidentiality, about having privacy, so that you know that your workload is private and is secure, and your data is private and secure, even when it is most cost effective or most expedient to be running that off in a cloud facility.
Yeah, so yeah, I think the interesting thing here is a lot of organizations tend to believe, like, for instance, a lot of organizations have a hybrid type network where they have an on-prem and the cloud solution. And they think, well, how can I ensure that every compute cycle that I have data, whether it's data coming from on-prem, whether it's data traveling through a virtual network or a network, a software controlled network, is secure at any point in time? Is it compliant at any point in time? How is this? How can systems guarantee that as things go on, as they evolve over time?
Yeah, hybrid is absolutely where it's at. You know, we see that people for a while were kind of making a cloud choice, and really now they're having a conversation about hybrid cloud architecture. How do I, like you said, how do I set up things that run in one place or maybe also have deployments out at the edge, you know, in a retail store, on a cruise ship, like you were talking about earlier? Cloud now kind of is in many locations, and hybrid cloud is about having that all be secure and consistent across all of the computing and all of the places that you need to be doing business as an enterprise, all the places that you're, you know, both running your applications and servicing your customers. And so confidential computing is about kind of when you're doing the computing, when you're doing the workload, that you know that it's run in a safe and secure way. But you want to, as you said, ensure that the data gets there securely. And so what we work on are, you know, end-to-end data encryption techniques. You know, we have as well in terms of encryption techniques that enable data to be computed on natively. Homomorphic encryption is a great, more forward-looking topic in this space. But basically, you have to encrypt and secure the data, get it to, you know, the cloud where you're going to be doing your computing, and then confidential computing ensures that even if that's a shared environment, that you're continuing to compute with complete and total privacy when you're there, you know, doing the actual work of the workload.
So it sounds like there's a lot of technology going on here, but is there a level of potential confidential standards that are out there today that maybe, you know, maybe IBM's focusing on or that the industry should be focusing on here when it comes to confidential computing?
Yeah, you know, Confidential Computing Consortium is a great organization. We participate in it. Red Hat participates in it. And, you know, they're really driving for, you know, consistency and understanding of what people can expect when they're, you know, using something that's referred to as confidential computing. But, you know, you mentioned also data protection earlier. So to kind of expand my statement a little bit, standards are always important. So we work on both things in open source and in standards with NIST and other organizations. So everything from confidential computing, which is a specific topic around securing the software and data wallets running through to data encryption and even quantum secure algorithms that never could be hacked in the future by a quantum computer. Those kind of things are efforts that we do in open source communities. We do them through libraries that we contribute to submissions that we make to standards organizations. And so folks really should be looking for standardized technologies. That kind of gives confidence, you know, in the adoption. And it also helps you ensure that you're picking a set of technologies that are going to be usable, you know, really for the next decade or two. Because when you make a significant cloud choice, when you make a, you know, specific, you know, decision about transforming your IT, that can be a long-term choice. And so you want to go with a vendor that's, you know, really looking at things from a standards perspective and also helping set those standards for the industry.
Right, right. That's great advice. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, a lot of organizations are, whether they're in a particular area or not, like, for instance, they could be getting into health eventually and they need to worry more about HIPAA and other standards that are out there. And you're having a cloud provider that's considering those things and making sure that they are standardized and compliant in that sense is a great, great way to future-proof things. I do want to get a little bit into some of the IBM new offerings, because we're hearing a lot of great things that's coming out of IBM, some new things that are actually raising some eyebrows. We heard recently about some of the latest offerings for IBM Secure Cloud. Can you maybe take us through some of that and how things have been changing here?
Yeah, and let me jump a little bit on. You mentioned sort of regulated industries, and healthcare data has come up a couple times today. Just want to relate sort of confidential computing then into those sort of regulated industry, and why does it matter that we can have a computer, you can be sure of the privacy of your workload and your data? Why it matters is because of those regulations and those standards, and those are meant to protect us as consumers. They're meant to protect an enterprise and its critical data. So our confidential computing technology deployed in our cloud is now part of solutions that have been done for the Apple CareKit, which is a HIPAA-ready capability to create software in the healthcare space, by Daimler, you know, who's looking to, you know, protect consumer data, and by many of the banks that we're working with. So to your question about offerings, one of the sets of offerings that we have around confidential computing is in our public cloud. We have everything from databases to secure Linux execution environments to what we call Data Shield, which enables you without modification to leverage confidential computing for containerized workloads and OpenShift workloads. So we have a whole bunch, a whole suite of very high functioning services. This is not toy technology. Confidential computing, we're on our fourth generation of it. And so, you know, we can deploy robust as a service cloud native capabilities in all these different areas. But also we're using this technology as the foundational work that we're doing as part of our Cloud for Financial Services, where, you know, over the summer we announced BNP Paribas in Europe and MUFG, Japan's largest bank, coming on board with us as partners. Within that ecosystem, we've announced nearly 50 ISV and SaaS providers that are coming on board as part of that ecosystem with us. And so we're able to basically take these core confidential computing techniques and technologies and then apply them to transform how an entire industry is actually now able to compute with confidence in cloud also.
So you've now piqued my interest, because you said that there's actually, this is the fourth generation. So maybe could you maybe take us through the evolution? How has it evolved, I think, over especially this year, and that's brought you to the fourth generation?
Yeah, we have this wealth of expertise. You mentioned standards, right? So IBM has a research institution that quite literally, I think, has rocket scientists and astronomers and all those things, right? So we have folks that can invent cryptography algorithms, and they have been inventing for quite some time in this space. We're a decade into this topic of confidential computing, and we've long contributed to those cryptographic algorithms that help you keep data secure when it's moving and other things like that. So we have been through multiple generations of work in confidential computing, and we released our first cloud services some time ago. And so we've been actually in full production with confidential computing and then able to apply it, you know, into these different industries. And so when I say fourth generation, literally, I mean like our fourth generation, the design of the technology that enables that privacy. And that confidentiality in computing. So we've really turned the crank on this. And what that has meant is we can do this over very large memory footprints and such. So not just, you know, play with it, but actually deploy in production with it, and use these technologies, you know, and what we in our marketing refer to as hyperprotect services, use these hyperprotect services even to run a whole database and such. And so it's really that maturity that comes through iterative design.
So this is definitely a meaty topic. So I want to bring my co-host back in because they're very interested in asking some stuff here. Curtis, I want to start with you. Curtis?
Well, now, I am curious. I'm very interested in what you've been saying about the confidential computing, but I'm really interested in knowing how this extends across hybrid architectures, because as we know from the research that pretty much everyone has done, most companies aren't doing single vendor in the cloud. There are lots of hybrid architectures, whether it's on-prem and cloud or public and private cloud or some variation. So how does what you're doing in confidential computing extend protection across some of these hybrid architectures?
Yeah, it's a great question because we talk about hybrid all day long, and that's absolutely it's where the industry is at. Everyone's using different locations for their computing these days. The specific thing that the industry consortium calls confidential computing really does require that it be a specific set of hardware and software technology that's deployed together. And that ensures that you have confidential computing. And so confidential computing in its most formal sense today is just really about kind of protecting a thing when it's running in one place. But what we do with our clients is to work together, you know, with them on overall strategies for identity and key protection and data encryption and encryption of data when it's in motion, so that across the whole hybrid journey or an application that's deployed in multiple locations, they can ensure security end to end. And a piece of that may be using confidential computing as an example when they're running in the cloud. And so it's really, you know, these days I would say, you know, when we work with financial services institutions or retailers or airlines, it's really all industries. Everyone's trying to move to the cloud. One of our recent surveys was 64% of executives are saying now that as a result of COVID, they have to move faster to cloud. This has kind of become existential. And so what we do is architect hybrid with end-to-end security, overall security monitoring. And then we have programs for consistency and security and compliance that help them establish frameworks across all of hybrid cloud. And then confidential computing it's a very specific term that refers to then, you know, being able to compute with privacy when they're then on systems, particular systems in the cloud.
Okay, well, that explanation makes complete sense, but I want to move to one more question of definition. And that is, when you're talking about confidential computing in the context of the shared responsibility model for mm-hmm. security, is confidential computing something that you offer as part of your responsibility to your customers? Is it something that you enable the customers to make possible on their end, or does it cut across both sides, both parties in that model?
It really is both. And I think, honestly, that's the exciting thing about it, because if as a cloud we just kind of throw things over the wall and say, good luck using it, then I don't think we've done enough, right? And so from the perspective of the confidential computing, we, as one example, we leverage confidential computing technology to stand up a keep your own key service. That gives the customer full control over their data. Our cloud operators have no way to get at the keys that are protecting the data. But we also then have to integrate that service and those capabilities into our other suite of services to ensure that there is, you know, ease of flow of data and ease of use, And then we integrate monitoring of use of that data protection technology into our security and compliance tooling. And that's where really we start to take on shared responsibility. So we are using confidential computing to deliver better protection of data to our clients to enable them to protect their data better. And then we're also delivering tooling that enables them to monitor, you know, are even their developers using the cloud in appropriate ways? And what is, you know, the continued compliance and security of what's been deployed?
Hillary, I spent many years working for the GSA Office of Information Security. And even back in those days, we had a lot of conversations about this brand new thing called the cloud. And it's like, oh, we're never going to be able to get something like that for any kind of, you know, classified computing. And then JEDI came. I had since left. And I was wondering, I haven't heard anything about IBM in the mix. Is this something you can actually talk about? Was JEDI flawed? You know, I considered the whole JEDI thing almost a bag of cats. Can you comment?
Yeah, so I'm going to pass on the JEDI question, but I will say that you're right to go to federal, right? You're right to go to government. And I was going, you know, to banking and financial services in this discussion, right? I think that we're seeing that across all regulated industries, and federal is, you know, very much regulated in the sense of, you know, has really strong obligations to protect things and very strong policies that have to be met by the technology. I think we're seeing across these sort of regulated spaces, across federal, across financial services, across healthcare, that new technologies really are needed in order to maintain the very high bar to get transformation to happen, right? Those programs that you mentioned are about transforming the way that the government consumes computing and having it be on as modern of a footing as possible. Same thing in financial services. When people are looking to digitally transform, you know, respond to the fact that, you know, digital banking usage is up 85%. They have to take those steps in federal. They have to take those steps in finance and regulated industry with a tremendous amount of care. They have to know how the data is getting there securely, and then is it secure when they're there? But it's ultimately about value to all of us, right? And so being able to construct cloud, you know, in a more secure way enables, you know, these agencies that are regulated and institutions that are regulated to move more quickly on digital transformation and get there and get to those better outcomes with cloud, because they know they're going to be able to compute with confidence and confidentiality when they get there.
Excellent. And JEDI, like I said, is a bag of cats. Don't blame me for backing away from that. Now, when I've been playing a lot with especially hybrid clouds, and Kurt and I were writing books on cloud security, one of the things that occurred to me is a lot of the vulnerabilities are in the interconnections between components. You've mentioned in your blog about this close-knit relationship with Red Hat. But what about people that are using other components? What kinds of rules, what kinds of boxes do we need to play with if we're going to play confidential computing?
Yeah, so the confidential computing specifically, you know, there's so much we could talk about security for hours, right? But confidential computing specifically kind of handles the workload that's running on the CPU and its caches and the memory system and stuff like that. So it's down at that level of ensuring appropriate isolation and privacy. But you're right. You know, the question is always, has that sort of, you know, tied me up in some way? Am I going to be restricted in what I can then run? And so we actually deliver confidential computing capabilities just on secure Linux systems, right? So that's a really broad space. And then also for containerized workloads, and then also for Red Hat OpenShift, which we've integrated this past summer into our Data Shield offering. So we do see that there needs to be, you know, a diversity in different types of environments that people have the chance, you know, to use confidential computing in. And so we have Linux, you know, containers, and then specifically OpenShift support.
So I'm assuming that there's probably going to have to be some sort of global services in there, because not every organization is prepared to make this paradigm shift into confidential computing. There's tools they need to learn how to use. And I'm assuming IBM's leveraging global services for that.
Yeah, you know, we always talk about a journey to cloud process, right? And I think it really is a process. And especially when you're concerned about data privacy, there's actually a better outcome that you can get sometimes in moving to cloud and rethinking your security architecture overall and stuff like that. And the opportunity to use confidential computing, which most people wouldn't have on premises, as an example. So there's a lot of benefits that can come in that process. But yeah, we are working closely with IBM Security Services, IBM Global Business Services in some of their, you know, transformation practices around core banking transformation, as an example, and with IBM Promontory, which, you know, is a regulatory advisory and has, you know, great depth of insight as to, you know, what do those regulations about trust and privacy and data protection mean, and how can those then be translated into the cloud context. And honestly, for me, that's the exciting part, right? Because customers come with, you know, to us looking to save cost or digitally transform or have a different outcome. And we want cloud computing to be a yes. We want it to be possible for that to be, you know, part of their solution. And we want the overall hybrid story to work together for them to bring value, to help them move more quickly, to digitally transform more quickly. And that's all of that is what cloud is supposed to enable. And having a specific focus on, you know, compliance and security, on confidential computing, et cetera, enables them to get to a yes, because there's a lot of tough questions, you know, from a risk and a security perspective that have to be answered. And we aim to streamline that process, everything from advisory and planning to, you know, hands on keyboard. And then actually there are live services that you can go and try out.
Now, I do want to make a minor shift here because our chat room is asking some questions here as well. And of course, we hear a lot about blockchain technology, and a lot of organizations are saying, hey, we would love to get our data into a blockchain, even potentially even our compute cycles reading data from blockchain. Is this something that IBM is seeing a lot of, and is the secure cloud capable of integrating with systems like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, when we talked about those generations of technology, one of the things we did kind of in what I would refer to as probably our last generation, our third generation of confidential computing, was actually stand up blockchain services using confidential computing technology. So the two journeys have been very, very much intermingled for us. And, you know, we do see interest in, you know, really interesting use cases, you know, on blockchain, you know, for, you know, secure protection of, you know, all kinds of, you know, supply chain things and logistics aspects, and you know, really interesting use cases emerging in that space for sure. And the two conversations for us have gone very much hand in hand.
This has been a fantastic conversation. We probably have, like you said, hours and hours more of content to talk about, but unfortunately, all good things must come to an end. Hillary, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate you being here. We're running a little bit low on time, but we did want to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home where they can go and learn more about IBM Cloud and IBM Secure Services.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I appreciate that. You know, we would welcome, you know, folks to contact us. IBM.com is our main landing page, but check out our cloud capabilities there. And also look at what we're doing in banking and financial services. I think that's one of the areas where confidential computing is coming to life most quickly. All that to say, confidential computing is not about, you know, just that particular industry. As I mentioned, you know, from Daimler to healthcare to ISVs and SaaS providers that we're working with, we're seeing a lot of interest in this technology, in particular our data protection technologies that are used using confidential computing. So, you know, wherever you are at in this journey to cloud, if you're already on cloud and you're having questions about did you make the right choices, or you're just looking to take the first steps, we really do view this as a journey and a partnership, especially in these times when everything's kind of churning around all of us. So we look forward to partnering with folks on these topics.
Well, thanks again for being here. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise and IT news podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-hosts in crime. Starting with the very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chiebert. What's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you online?
First off, apologies to Hillary about Jedi, but kind of had to go there. I'm on Twitter, ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. or drop me an email. I'm Chebert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T, at twit.tv. My students had a Dilbert naming theme. But better yet, why don't you drop an email to twiet at twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. We'd love to hear from you. A lot of the topics that we're covering are driven by our viewers. I go and talk to the PR people, and they said, well, you know, we have people, we can hook you up. What kind of topics? I'll go to my list of topics that I've gotten from our viewers and say, oh, well, how about this? And you know what? It's made a difference. Our viewers seem to really like the shows. We try to make sure that there's something for the folks that are just getting started, all the way up to the IT management. And supposedly we've gotten some comments from thinly veiled C-suite folks. So, you know, we hear from all kinds of people, and we want to keep hearing from you. Thank you for watching, and see you next week.
Thanks, Chebert. We also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you and all your work?
Well, I'm oddly enough not traveling to any conferences in the next couple of weeks, but I am going to be attending a couple of virtual conferences. Went to one this last week for a vendor called Splunk. That was interesting. And I have some articles coming up that I hope will be interesting on things like printer vulnerabilities and some of the fascinating potential ransomware targets now that we've seen some proofs of concept out there. Also have a piece coming up on a program where an individual who has put together previously some training to help get women into cybersecurity is putting some of those programs in the field to benefit people who have lost their jobs due to the coronavirus pandemic. So lots of interesting stuff coming up. Please follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA and come on over to Dark Reading, and especially The Edge of Dark Reading, to find all of the things that I write.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your IT pro and enterprise news. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to our show. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/twiet. They all find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the guest information, the co-host information, of course, all the links of the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll see those really helpful and subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices or any one of your podcast applications, on all of them. So definitely check it out and subscribe. The best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news is by subscribing. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, your coworkers with the gift of Twiet, because we talk about a ton of really great technology subjects here and some fun stuff. So sharing with them, they'll also find it interesting as well. So definitely have them subscribe and share it with them. If you're actually available, Fridays, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do this show live. You can check it out at live.twit.tv, and you can see how the show is run, the behind the scenes, how the pizza's made, all the fun stuff. And of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into our chat room live as well. We have a really great set of characters in there that ask some great questions, some great topics. That's irc.twit.tv. You can jump in there and be part of the show. But hey, we know you have a busy lives. You can't be always part of the live discussion, the live show, but you still want to be part of the discussion and maybe even the Twit community. So you can do that. You can still do that. Twit.community. It's a great website. Check it out, twit.community. It's a 24/7 website. We have a ton of great discussions out there. The co-hosts, the hosts are out there. Really great Twit community. We talk a lot about the shows. We talk a lot about technology, some really great subjects. So definitely check out that website and be part of the discussion 24/7. Remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my latest and greatest ways that I actually can customize and make Office better for you. But of course, I also have some great enterprise tidbits, and I also have some good discussions with people like you. So definitely follow me, and we'll have some great discussions. I also want to thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support and all their guidance over the years. Of course, I also have to thank all the engineers and staff at Twit. They support us each and every week, and we can't do this show without them. And of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time. Chiebert, he's not only our co-host and our friend, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the show bookings and he does all the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do it without him. So thanks again, Chiebert, for all your support and all of your support over the years. Now, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor for today. Of course, I think it's Victor this week. Congratulations to him as well. He has lots of fun stuff going on in the background, and I really appreciate all of his hard work. Plus, we also thank our TD for today, Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant, you are a busy, busy guy. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about, give us a sneak peek of this week and maybe what's upcoming?
Well, there's been some fine hands-on wellness content released, as well as we now have 1 year of hands-on photography out there for you. So go on out there and download all of those episodes. Get your learning on.
Absolutely, absolutely. Some good content there. I've learned a lot from Ant over the years, especially in photography. So definitely check all of that stuff out. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep twiet.
Want more Twit? Well, check out Smart Tech Today. It's at twit.tv/STT. It's the show where Matthew Casinelli and I cover everything there is to know about smart tech. It's automation, it's connected devices, it's smart home, it's all those goodies and so much more. We get the news, we get the latest devices, we do reviews, everything. You got to check it out. twit.tv/STT for Smart Tech Today.